This TFMR podcast is brought to you by your friends at JM Bullion. Visit jmbullion.com for all your gold and silver bullion needs. Well, greetings out there to everybody at TFMR. Hey, it is actually Tuesday, November the 10th, but right now we are presenting to you your Thursday conversation for November the 12th. And it is my pleasure to bring back in our old friend, Ned Naylor-Leyland. Ned, of course, money manager in the mining sector for Jupiter Asset Management in London, a friend of TFMR since the beginning. And it's always great to get caught up with him. Ned, thank you for giving me a few minutes.
It's my pleasure. Always great to catch up.
It is. It is great to catch up. And I cannot believe that it has now been 4 years since we've seen each other. I think they invented this COVID stuff just to keep us from crossing the Atlantic and playing some golf, my friend.
We'll do that at some point.
Yes, we will. In fact, I've told Mrs. F on a number of occasions that when Bitcoin gets to 28,000, which is Max Kaiser's target or short-term target, I'm going to sell a fraction of one and we're flying first class over to play golf in Scotland and Ireland. So I suspect you'll be getting an invitation to join me for a round or two.
Well, you'll be playing at Sunningdale too, so you just store that up.
I cannot wait, my friend. All right, we might as well just dive right in. It is, like I said, Tuesday the 10th as we record this. Couple of significant news items in the past week. Obviously, the results of the U.S. election. And then we've got this news that hit yesterday about a possible pending COVID vaccine. And man, did they take the metals and the mining shares to Poundtown as soon as all that stuff hit. But Ned, I want to start with getting your thoughts on the big picture. Here at TFMR, people are probably sick and tired of hearing me talk about it, about time in the market, not timing the market, understanding the big picture, the bullish fundamentals, and not letting yourself get shaken off. Where do you see us here in mid-November of 2020, and where do you see us heading in 2021?
Well, obviously, things look a lot better than they did 12 months ago, and a lot better still than they did 24 months ago. I think we're in a funny spot right now because, you know, clearly the political dramas are, you know, in play, which slightly changes the situation. But of course, overall, we're expecting more stimulus, we're expecting more ridiculous promises which can't be kept. And all of that will drive real interest rates down and gold and silver higher. So I think that what I would say is definitely dips are being bought, as we saw in the last 24 hours, actually. Indeed, in the fund that we run, we did exactly that. As soon as the dip completed itself, I was out buying. And I think, you know, that there's definitely a sea change overall. We have increased participation, albeit bit by bit at the moment. And, you know, I think that silver, of course, is the real story due to the fact that there's no way that the SLV, even if they did add nearly 300 million ounces in a quarter, there's certainly no way they're doing that again or on a rolling basis. And yet the interest in silver and why one might own it is much more apparent now than it was 6 months ago, a year ago, or frankly, any time before that. So look, I think things look really good, but you know, we're in for a strange few months. I'm sure you would agree.
You touched on two things there. I know you're one of the people that taught me about the importance, the long-term relationship between gold specifically and negative real interest rates. Any reason to think real interest rates could trend toward or even move positive anytime soon?
Well, not really. I mean, it could happen in a deflationary bust, which of course is certainly a danger. So for example, if the election result continues to be contested and gets worse, and the man in the middle, as I like to call him, Chairman Powell, became unavailable, then yes, I think that could happen, but I don't think it's a real medium or long term thing. You know, they can't allow yields to rise materially. They want more inflation. Negative rates are on the table. So look, I think structurally that looks great. And is, as you say, is the primary tailwind until the physical market breaks, of course, is the primary tailwind for the sector.
Yeah. Let's double back to silver for a second too, because I'm sure you've seen, well, even Goldman Sachs came out with a bullish price target, but a couple of months ago, there was something from, oh, it was either Bank of America or Morgan Stanley talking about $40 silver. And then, Dad, I saw something, somebody posted on my site yesterday that had Citigroup calling for $100 silver. What do you make of some of these banks that are making those calls?
Well, I think it's very, very interesting. I think it's very interesting. And I certainly use it internally at work to help with the narrative. Now, of course, you and I know that's not really how it works. So additional EV demand, solar, 5G, Internet of Things, you know, and all the rest of it is a good narrative. But that's, you know, silver is just driven through real interest rates like gold is. It just has a higher beta, as an American might say. So that's not really how it works until, of course, as I say, the market breaks, and then sure, those things matter a lot, but I don't care, and neither should you. It doesn't matter. The fact that they've latched onto that narrative, which is also true, which is that, you know, if you want to do a new Green Deal and you want all of these things to happen, then it's going to consume vast amounts of silver. So there's a narrative fail, really, with what they're saying, because that's not how the price action works. But so be it. If that drives investors to own silver, even a silver ETF or silver miners, because of their belief that that's how price discovery works, then great. And it's certainly very different than anything either of us have seen in 20 years. Right. And yeah, I think Fidelity spoke about it as well. And they're all saying it, and that's very good news.
Yeah. Yeah, you would think. Regardless of why or how, it's just nice to have that information. It's certainly going to help institutional investors look at it. I'm thinking of that Minard guy. Yeah. Was Scott Minard at Guggenheim?
Guggenheim,
same kind of thing. All right. So then, Ned, let me pick your brain here for a minute. As I said, your day job is as a money manager, mining sector, precious metal money manager. Why, Ned, does everybody hate us? Why does everybody hate the mining shares? I mean, we all are sitting here. I'm looking right now at the GDX trading basically at the same level it was in May coming off of first quarter earnings based off of $1,500 gold. And yet now we have third quarter earnings based off of $1,900 gold. We've got increased or reinstatement of dividends. We've got tremendous earnings growth, great free cash flow generation. And yet the shares, if you measure, you take the GDX as an aggregate, haven't changed. Why did anybody love us, Ned?
So there's some complicated and some uncomplicated points here. Look, the GDX, GDXJ, you need to realize that they are really profoundly dependent on flows from the leveraged investment space. So institutionally, you know, Citadel, these big guys, they have big, big positions through those products. And when, you know, yesterday was a brilliant example of it, where they're offside on all sorts of trades. And, you know, this gets caught up in the mess. And we saw it back in March as well. And it's very annoying that patient long-term gold bugs who are fully paid investors are at the whim of, frankly, quite spivvy leveraged institutional money. But I'm afraid it's the case. I don't think it's true that gold miners are hated per se. I think the silver and silver miners are kind of nearly hated. I mean, you know, because of course the silver bug being the sort of radical gold bug, you know, the right. Institutional space has limited patience for the likes of me and my chat. You know, they probably like you because you're a sort of sensible fellow. But now I tend to say that there is there is an emotive component here, which is that if you spoke to other people who run money in a broader based equity market or in other slots, that they would say that the narrative of cyclical monetary collapse and reset and all the things that we know are happening, you know, is not something they want to engage with. But I would say that they don't hate gold miners. You know, I think that when we do clear 2100 and leave it behind in dollar gold terms, what you're going to see is a complete change. Because if you go back and you look at the late 1970s, when the price went straight up, it only went straight up when we left behind the highs from, I think it was 74. So there'd been a big rally in the early 70s. And then obviously gold corrected 50% in the middle of the 1970s. And it wasn't until the market felt that previous high was gone. You know, that was not a thing.
Right. But
then you saw a big change in behavior. And I, personally, I actually sort of would defend people who haven't invested so far for saying, I want to see that go before I participate. You know, they're generally those kind of people are very benchmark led. They're quite scared of their own shadow. They want to be in the middle of the pack. They don't like to take big views. And they'd like to see that high that we had earlier this year. And of course, obviously the one from 2011, 2012, they want to see that done. And that's even more true in silver, where we've never seen sustainable $20 plus silver prices ever. It's quite an interesting thing if you think about that. You know, it's never happened. So why would you? You know, why would you go at 25 and go, oh, I'm piling in here? You know, if you understand, you will, you know, like we do. But I get it. You know, they want to see what was previously a ceiling become a floor. And also, you know, silver mining stocks particularly, they've struggled to deliver sustainable margins for so long that, you know, they will become a much more interesting risk-reward opportunity when silver's at 35, weirdly, than where they are at the moment. Because, you know, they'll have decent margins up there and there's enough headroom for investors to feel confident about, you know, the direction of travel. So I think that will all change. And what's crucial is that investors, institutional investors principally I'm talking about, will be able to ignore the narrative. So they will be able to say, this stuff that Craig and Ned talk about is just nonsense. You know, they're not interested in any of that. I'm still ignoring that. They're still wrong. But I will accept that these stocks are doing better on a sustained basis. They do make sense. It's a pain trade not owning them. So I'm going to start to participate. So I wouldn't get too hung up on they hate the miners. They don't understand them well. And I try and help my colleagues understand that, of course, they're more like a form of call option than they are a normal equity.
Yeah.
And when they're reframed in that way, actually, they're more interesting to the average investor because they start to think in a different way about what they're looking at. But I think that, you know, all of this is set to change with a break of those highs. Then I think, you know, behavior will change in the broader market and they can forget, they can reject, you know, what we like to talk about. Say that's irrelevant. I'm not interested in that. It's just a performance-based decision. I'm going to rotate and continue to move in that direction. And of course, Buffett doing it is, of course, you know, at the margin, an important thing as well.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree with that. And it is kind of a, you know, you've probably heard me refer to it as the rule, you know, of less than 1% of all global assets invested in the sector. And you know, what happens if that goes to 2%? And it's just a matter of getting those floodgates open. And I think you're right. That's what we've been talking about here on the site is making another new set of highs versus what we saw last summer ought to do it. In our time remaining, Ned, I want to get you kind of a two-pronged question. One, it is in terms of that, I guess we'll call it institutional demand, but also I guess is just in terms of running the company, is it a good idea for these big producers to be increasing dividends or reinstating dividends versus acquiring more assets? Do you think is that looked upon fondly by institutional investors and you know, and everybody else? And then two, we're talking about, you know, what would they be buying? Well, they'd be buying exploration companies. So can you talk a little bit about the opportunity that you see in that smallest part of the sector?
Yeah, I see them as two different things, really. I think the majors now are very, very investable. I mean, people will wait, but they're very investable. You know, they have big margins. They should sustainably be able to serve it up here. They're also big and liquid. And, you know, investors are quite happy to go buy direct stocks elsewhere that are of a similar size, some which pay dividends and some don't. So I don't see any issue with owning those. But so far as what the market wants, I don't think the market's that nuanced yet on it, actually. I don't think the market's quite sophisticated enough to know whether it wants dividends or to chase growth now. Of course, the right thing to do is absolutely to make acquisitions a year ago, let alone now, and not right. in 2 years. But of course, that won't happen, and it is what it is. But it's funny you bring up the rule. What I would like to do as well is just make an observation, which I think is very important, and will be food, will be music to the ears, by the way, of most of the people on the site, which is that I think that there's something that is repeated often about the juniors and about exploration stocks, which I think is complete nonsense. I understand why it's come about, but I really feel it's a backward-looking comment which needs to be looked at carefully, which is this idea that only 1 in 100 exploration targets becomes a mine. What you've got to remember is, we you know, the gold price has been repressed for 40 years, as we know, only too well, and silver since 1944, really. Now, what's happened as a result is the stocks, thanks to real interest rates being kept higher than they should have been through, you know, central bank behavior, there hasn't been sufficient free cash flow for majors to reinvest in research and development, which, of course, is exploration and development in their case. Now, what that's meant is that this comment about you know, what you're going to find and how difficult it is made sort of, it sounds rather like sort of two drunk old fools around a campfire after too much whiskey. Because the truth is that actually the exploration geologists have had 40 years to identify where they think the next big deposits are. What's been lacking has been capital, nothing else. And indeed, what's more is, of course, is that the technology involved in looking for new gold and silver deposits has changed dramatically and is far better now than it was before. So I'm not at all surprised to see that there are big discoveries being made right now. And you know what? This is within a few months of funds like the one I run handing large checks across to exploration development companies to go do that drilling. And I think this is very interesting and exciting. And there are new frontiers of exploration. Principally, the one that interests me is the Pilbara in northern Western Australia, where geological beliefs and dogma are being thrown out the window, which again, dogma, beliefs and perceived wisdom being thrown under a bus is always going to make you and me happy.
Right.
But you know, that's very much happening there at the moment. And I think that, you know, you should be excited by the potential for owning, you know, if you can own ounces in the ground in a tier one jurisdiction, Australia being a good example, that are hugely discounted relative to the valuation put on ounces in the ground held by producers. And bear in mind that those ounces are growing because there's drilling going on. You know, this is a great opportunity for investors. So, you know, I feel really quite torn because you know, producers are great and they have their merit and they will attract big institutional money in a way that the lower sort of part of the food chain won't. But I really profoundly believe that the exploration development part of the market, which has obviously behaved well for the last 6 months, has a very interesting couple of years, 3 years ahead of them.
Yeah. In the end, it hinges off of whether we're right about the prevailing big picture, you know, and the debt monetization and the negative real interest rates and everything that goes with it. I've seen nothing to change that big picture in the last couple of weeks or months. Have you?
Well, no, obviously the opposite is the case, which is it just becomes more and more obvious.
Well, then we shall persevere, my friend. I think that's about all we can do. I've hit the main points that I wanted to hit over the last 20 or 25 minutes. Anything else on your mind as we go to wrap up?
No, I just would press that point, which I know a mutual friend of ours has made to you before about SLV and and what's going on in silver. You know, just remember that Jeff Christian said back in May, I think it was, that he was expecting, I can't remember exactly what the number was, but it was about half of the silver that's supposedly been added to SLV. About half of what's been added was supposed to be total investment demand globally for the whole year. Mm-hmm. Now, you know what? This looks like this actually, in terms of actual signals from the system, telling you that they're in serious trouble. I would say that this is the best single piece of news that I've seen in the background for the direction of travel since we've both been looking at this. You know, that is most definitely not sustainable. And the idea that Robinhood traders could be the ones to pull the pants down at the bullion banks is just delicious. You know, I mean, it's so silly, but also kind of how human behavior works as well. You know, it probably, with the benefit of hindsight, wasn't ever going to be me and you doing it. But the idea that Robinhood inadvertently, with their interest in the volatility in silver, would cause a problem for the system through SLV, I think is fascinating and is definitely a subject to keep an eye on.
A bunch of guys not even wearing pants in the first place, pulling the pants down to the banks. I hope it happens one day. That, you know, any extra pressure they can put on them, obviously we're all for it. And it's going to be a very interesting 2021. My friend, I wish you all the best. You're probably under some sort of lockdown over there in London at present, aren't you?
Sadly, yes.
Goodness gracious. Well, one day, my friend, one day, this too shall pass, and we'll be on the golf course together. Between now and then, though, hey, I think it's probably time I can wish you a happy holiday season even, Ned. It's close enough.
Absolutely, yes. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. And to all of the Naylor Leylands, please pass that along. And thank you so much for your time and all the time that you've spent with me over the last 10 years making the site what it is. I don't think I could have done it without you. So thank you for all your ongoing efforts, my friend. And please keep that nose to the grindstone.
That's a monstrous exaggeration, but I'm grateful for the generous comment.
All right, my friend. Thank you for your time.
Not at all.
And from all of us at TFMR, thank you for listening to this week's Thursday Conversation. We'll have another one for you next week.